Welcome to Profiles in Risk, the INS Nerds podcast, the only recurring podcast dedicated to insurance careers, insurtech startups, and insurance current events. We are your hosts, Carly Burnham, Tony Cañas, and Nick Lamparelli. You can find all of our podcasts, show notes, and other great insurance-related content at insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to Episode 2 of Profiles in Risk, the INS Nerds podcast. I am your host, Nick Lamparelli, and with me are my co-hosts and co-founders of insnerds.com, Carly Burnham and Tony Cañas. Hi, Carly. Hi, Tony.
Hey.
Episode 2. We made it to Episode 2. What do you guys think of that?
Very excited. Now,
it's pretty
episode
exciting.
One hasn't been released as we record episode 2, so much more excited tomorrow once it releases.
Yeah, I'll have to say that a podcast is much more difficult than I thought it would be. In one way, I think we'll have lots to talk about, and I think our audience is going to love all of the topics and all of our diverse opinions and very eloquent opinions. But the technical side of it is pretty challenging, staying up till midnight trying to splice audio files together. Not easy to do.
I'm glad you guys are handling that.
So, Carly, Tony, for the audience's sake, I think we're going to spend a lot of time on these podcasts going over the prior week. So I'm going to kick this over to Carly and Tony. And for the week prior, what were some of the publications that were on insnerds.com that the audience might be interested in hearing about?
So last week we had a new guest author, Taryn, write a piece for us on why she loves her insurance career. She has a very interesting background prior to coming to insurance, and we were very excited to share that with the audience.
I really, really, really loved that article. When I read it, I literally cried. I'm not even joking. Now, I cry at movies, I cry at commercials, but the reason I cried is because my first thought is, if I can put this article in front of every high schooler in America, our talent problem is solved in 4 years. Because she makes a wonderful case as to why insurance is a great place for those of us who are nerdy or who are a little bit off. And I think it's wonderful compared to what a lot of people think about insurance, which is that it's very straight, very in the box, very, you know, button down. So I really loved it. We barely edited. We pretty much went live the way she wrote it.
Tony, to that end, do you want to tell the audience how you met Taryn?
Yes. So basically, I'm always on the hunt for guest authors. And what happened here is I became active in Reddit. So I've been subscribed to Reddit for a long time. I've never really jumped into Reddit. It's always been a bit intimidating. So I became active in the last couple of weeks in the Insurance Pros Reddit. And they are really careful as to who they let in. Like, you pretty much have to send your resume and convince them that you're an actual insurance pro. It took me a couple of days. And finally, when I got in, I started becoming really active, and she was active there, so that's how we connected. And I can't remember the exact topic we connected on, but basically I reached out to her and said, hey, you've got kind of an interesting story there. Let's chat. And we had a really fun video chat a couple of weeks ago, and at the end I said, hey, let's do, how about this and this and this and this and that, and I really challenged her to come up with crazy ways to apply her philosophy background to her insurance career and write us a few fun articles. I look forward to see what else she comes up with.
I love that story about how you met, because we always talk about how insurance is about relationships, and we talk about how I'm an introvert, so finding ways to connect with people is always something that I'm focused on. And so hearing that there's an active insurance group on Reddit is fantastic. I think that speaks to a place where millennials can get engaged in a format that they're comfortable in.
So very good, so, very good point.
Well, what
so then we had another article by Mr. Lamparelli. Do you want to tell us what that was about?
Sure, my article. Yes. So the title of my article is that you are a salesperson, whether you like it or not. And that article is very important to me, and expressing that message is very important to me. I wouldn't say I've had a long career. I'm not that old, but in my business career, being able to persuade and being able to sell something is probably the most important business skill that you can have. You can't get things done unless you can persuade people. You need to persuade your boss to move a project forward or to allow you to work on a project. You need to persuade the executive team to provide funding to your project. You're asking for a raise. You're asking for a bonus. You're asking for a job. You're selling an insurance policy. It's all around you, and it's a really difficult skill set. I didn't write that article as a way of saying I am a superstar salesperson, listen to me. I wrote that article as an amateur golfer would write an article about Tiger Woods. You can see the skill set. You can see what needs to be done. You want to slide and get to that level. And that was the point and the purpose of that particular article. Was like, I gave a few tidbits, but it's to be able to be a good persuader, to be able to get things done, to be able to sell things, to get things moving. It's a skill set. It requires a lot of training. One thing I regret not putting in there is that you can't just read a book. You can't just listen to a podcast. In order to become better at persuading people, you actually have to practice it. You have to fail. You have to be really bad at it so that you can figure out what you did wrong and improve. So that's something that's very close to me, and I'm sure for everyone in the audience that's developing a career, you will probably see articles like that here or there, or mentions of that article in future insnerds.com publications that I have.
I agree. I found that one very exciting as well. The resources that you included at the end were fantastic. I think, like you said, finding ways to practice those skills, even by doing things like trying to reduce your payments on your internet connection, or calling in and trying to haggle over your cable bill, are great places to start that don't necessarily affect your career.
Carly, you you spent a good 2 or 3 years of your early career on the phone sales, literally like front end sales for Nationwide, and you've said how you're an introvert. So an article like this, it kind of has to piss you off. It kind of has to like, I'm just wondering how it makes you feel to be forced to be a salesperson when personality wise it's not your favorite thing to do.
Introverts make fantastic salespeople, Tony.
But do you enjoy
it? There's lots of research showing that we can be very good at it. I enjoyed it when I worked in the agency because I was able to make a human connection and truly use some skills that Nick mentioned, such as listening. Doing it over the phone in a high-speed setting was a little bit more challenging, but it's important to find a way to connect with those people over the phone as well. So I've had a lot of practice at it.
Gotcha. So you enjoyed the article?
I enjoyed the article very much, okay. Yes.
Good.
God, I hope so.
Actually, one of my favorite business books is about sales.
Which one?
The Principles of Influence by Cialdini.
Cialdini? Yeah,
yes.
All the Cialdini books are great.
Yes, he has a new one. So I linked to both of those in my article that I published, and we should link to those in the show notes so that the audience can quickly find those. But both of those books are fantastic, and And what I appreciate about the Cialdini books is he comes at it from a scientific point of view. He's not trying to teach you to become a sociopath where you're able to completely manipulate people.
I take offense to that.
He just talks about the science of the brain and what is going on in the background when you apply some of these persuasion techniques. And I would say, for the most part, they're pretty gentle persuasion techniques.
They're very gentle.
Yeah.
That's why I love it.
Yeah.
Good stuff. I think compared to How to Win Friends and Influence People, hands down, Cialdini is much, much gentler and doesn't come off like a sociopath, which is great.
There's about 60 years worth of advancement in the science of persuasion between one and the other. I think both are important books. But I love the fact that Cialdini I really enjoy books that are based on research. Things like The Happiness Advantage, where like somebody's done the serious research and is telling us what works, not because they think it works, but because they've tested it and it works.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so we will. Why don't we transition over to current events and talk about a few things that we've been chatting about on our own, and I think things that the audience would like to hear. And so we'll put this link up on the show notes, but Tony shared with Carly and myself a very interesting article he found on Medium by an author called Genevieve Kubica, who's pretty much the title of it, I think, was kind of confusing. I don't think it matched the article very well. The title is How Will Ethereum and Blockchain Services Like WeTrust Disrupt Insurance? But much of the article, what we were talking about, and I think what I'll kick over to Tony and Carly, I thought much of the article was really just slamming insurance, and I thought a lot of it had pretty much no basis in fact. A lot of data here, for example, the Great Fire of London and all of the insurance companies that went out of business, but no footnotes to that. So I don't know if that's true or not. Tony, you left a remark in here, and I wanted to reply and say what Tony said. But
remark, hate letter, I don't know, death threat. I'm not sure exactly what it was. It was kind of long.
You're the one that found this particular article, but stuff like this really gets my goat. I don't think there's a lot of basis. In fact, they take a lot of the myths of insurance and really use that to their advantage to try to market. So this is, for the audience's sake, this is bad persuasion right here. But Tony, why don't I kick it over to you? What bothered you so much about this article?
Okay. So I guess I'll start on this one. I think that the blockchain is, once we figure out how to use it in insurance, it's gonna make huge differences. And those differences might or might not involve somehow disintermediating the carriers a little bit. A lot of carriers are investing in it, so maybe we'll figure out how to do it correctly. I've read several books about it, and I still can't really get my head around it. Quite. That's why we don't have a good article on it on the site yet. But what really bothered me about it is the lemonade thing, right? It's apparently in fashion when you start an insurtech company to start by talking about how insurance screws everybody. And I joked about it last time in our last podcast about how we charge as much as we can and then we, you know, cut people off once we have a claim. And of course, I was joking, but it really got me this lack of understanding. This woman, she's not really an insurance person. Looking at her profile on LinkedIn, she's got about a year in insurance at a San Francisco agency. But before that, she's done other things, and I don't doubt that she's bright. She's very well educated for sure, but. She doesn't understand the industry, and it's very clear from the article. And so, yeah, she's pushing a lot of the of the ideas that Lemonade was pushing, that the we are unfair to customers, and especially what really got me is the this idea that we're making the policy language complicated in order to screw you. And that is simply not true. I've worked at four carriers. You guys have worked at probably another four together. And I have never met anybody in any carrier that has told me that in training that's what they told them to do. They tell us the exact opposite. The language is complicated because what we're doing is complicated and because the courts tend to interpret it in particular ways. And if the courts interpret it in a broader way than we intended, then in the long term that's not profitable. So the language became complicated because it's a complicated issue.
Let me read that part for the audience sake so they can understand the context. So this is from the Medium article. Insurance companies also overcomplicate the language they use for the purpose of not having to pay out the full amount in the event of a claim. They must figure that if you do not ask for clarity or hire a broker, then you deserve what you get. That is a flawed system that needs fixing post haste. Carly, you're an underwriter. I see this all the time with technologists that come into insurance. They think this is done on purpose. I think Tony did a really good job of explaining it. I don't think technologists understand when they come in that the insurance policy is a legally binding contract. So it has legal standing.
I think you recently published an article on our site about a framework on how to look at insurtech companies. One of the things that I run into when I think about insurtech companies, when I've spoken with people who are trying to get something started, is, like Tony said, a lack of respect for the industry and a disinterest in trying to understand the history. It's very frustrating as someone who's inside the industry and who knows people who work on claims, knows agents that truly care about their customers. One story that I shared in my Why I Love Insurance piece was sitting at a table with a person who had been a claims representative for one of the bigger carriers for about 20 or 30 years. And we were talking to insurance students who were in college studying insurance, and they were at this event trying to network and meet people. And he said, if you go to a company and you can't find a claims adjuster who has cried after settling a claim, you should reconsider working at that company. That story is not unique. I think most companies have employees that feel that way. And most of us believe that what we're doing is for the greater good. You'll see bad actors in any industry. But to generalize and say that we write our policies in a way that is intentionally confusing is very frustrating. And you see this all the time.
I also found it interesting that on one paragraph, she's kind of poo-pooing on one paragraph. She's saying, you know, the carriers look at it as if you didn't get a broker, that's your own fault. You get what you get. And two paragraphs later, she's talking about cutting out the agent, right? So it's just not even internally cohesive. And by the way, you guys are not the only people I sent it to. I kind of called in the cavalry. I sent it to Bill Wilson, who will be addressing it at insurancecommentary.com. I figured that he was, with his 40-some years of experience, in a much better place than me to really dig into it. So I look forward. And he replied yesterday at like 9:30 p.m. saying thank you, and I'll definitely be addressing this on my blog.
I'm excited to see that.
So I'll definitely forward that to you guys.
Yeah, but this is a common theme. You know,
it is.
In my Lemonade Hype article that we published last year, at the end of last year, that's something I specifically talked about. It was this notion that the insurance industry is purposely out to get people, that it's their money, not the client's money, and they'll look for any which way to avoid paying out a claim, and I know it from personal experience that, and I wrote this in the article, during a CAT, I specifically remember seeing an email going out that said, be quick, be fair, and if there's any ambiguity, any gray area, settle in the favor of the customer. And that told me all I needed to know. And that's not an isolated story. I've heard that so many times from colleagues at other companies. So we have a lot of work to do if trying to get millennials excited about this when this kind of stuff is floating around.
The reality is that the majority of consumers are satisfied. If you look at J.D. Power's and read commentary on claims, or if you have ever talked to a customer who's had a claim covered and taken care of, generally they're happy. People who write articles like this seem to me to be people who, or people who say things like this, seem to me to be people who have not had an experience with an insurance company settling a claim. So they have an idea, a stereotype in their mind, and then they lambast the entire industry without any personal experience.
That's one of the really tricky things in our industry is 95, in personal lines at least, 95% of our customers at the end of the year have not had a claim. So It's hard for them to understand where their money went. And yeah, the 5% that did have a claim, the great majority of them are satisfied or beyond satisfied. But the other 95% are wondering where their money went, and it's very tricky.
So you hear technologists say, we've heard it a million times. Every time we go into some new industry, they tell us, well, our industry is different. But what I try to tell them is that, well, this one is different. This one is the only industry where the consumer pays something and doesn't immediately get anything. Think of Amazon and Uber, and even if you're trading on E-Trade, when you pay for something, you get something back. It's tangible almost, even if it's some kind of service. So if you go to your accountant to get your taxes done, you're getting something immediately. Insurance, you're only getting a promise.
It's I will fall on our sword. I do think part of it is our own fault. We have not done a good job of selling this. We haven't done a good job of selling this to our own employees. The cognitive science, the psychology research directly applying to insurance has been out for a few years. And as an industry, we have been slow to apply what it's taught us. So there are things like giving a small refund at the end of the policy. Even if you're getting charged a little bit more upfront, just feeling like you're getting something back, things like that would make a big difference psychologically. I'll try to remember which book I read that in, and I'll include it in the show notes. But that's one of the things that Lemonade is doing very well, is trying to grab that psychological research about how people perceive insurance and actually make it part of their overall value to the customer.
Okay. Well, with that said, that's a great segue to the very next topic, which is news that Tesla's coming out and basically saying that their cars are going to be so safe that the car owner will not need to buy auto insurance, that there'll be some kind of insurance associated with the vehicle. And Tony, from what you just finished saying, and a conversation Carly and I had before we started recording, I think this is part of that psychology. I think the embedding of insurance into other products. So you get your auto insurance from your vehicle. You get your car. You get your. You know, I can imagine situations where a sprinkler company would come into your home, design an entire fireproofing system, and basically say, you don't need fire insurance. If there's a fire, we'll pay for it. That's how confident we are in our product. And I, you know, to going from what you said, Tony, I think I envision 5 to 10 years from now that these small things will turn into new products, new business models, insurance as a service or prevention as a service.
So where do the carriers fit into that world of very little risk, a world of very little car accidents with very little burnt homes? When I went through Nationwide's financial leadership rotation program, we met with several vice presidents in the company, and one of them told us that he's not really worried about self-driving cars because, number one, the company is well-diversified, and number two, our key skill is managing risk, and there will always be risk. So I think that it's a matter of moving forward in the process from handling the claim after it happens to helping you avoid that risk up front. I think that's where real value will be 20 years from now. But about this Tesla article, I found it on the Reddit group that I was talking about, the Insurance Pros Reddit subreddit, and a lot of the reactions there were, well, what if a person moves, right? That would complete, like, are we going to charge them extra premium if they move, or refund them if they move to a safer place? And it's going to take a change of thinking for us underwriters in the industry, and I think we'll learn to underwrite this as a fleet and as a product liability instead of a personal liability. What do you think, Carly? I don't know.
I think specific to the Tesla situation, we'll have to start thinking about that as a fleet if they're self-driving. It will be interesting to see the perception from a consumer. One of the things that is unclear yet is whether the consumer will have a choice of which carrier provides that insurance. And if you have a traditional mindset of purchasing the insurance on your own, it may be confusing to just have it lumped in with the vehicle, because you're still going to be thinking that you have an impact on how many claims you might have. Tesla is saying that the driver will not have an impact.
You bring up a really good point, which is the moral hazard that if I lease the car or buy the car from Tesla, Tesla provides the insurance and it's underwritten as a fleet. The moment I realize that my own behavior no longer affects my premium, unless the car is 100% self-driven, you've got a real moral hazard there where I'll drive like a maniac, or I could drive like a maniac. I'm no longer afraid for my insurance premiums.
Or I park somewhere that I wouldn't generally park, or I leave my keys in the car, or I don't lock the doors when I leave. Although you can imagine a Tesla that locks as soon as the door shuts, so I guess that would be irrelevant.
Are you sure they'll be able to have the technology in time?
Well, they don't know when they're going live with this, right? This is just an idea that Elon Musk has.
This is just an idea. Correct. And by the way, it's not just the insurance. It's also the maintenance. That's
exactly
what he said. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because Teslas are very expensive, but they are very cheap to maintain because they have very few moving parts. That big battery is the only problem. But as he starts building those batteries cheaper and cheaper in the Gigafactory in Nevada, really, like, it makes sense to offer the customer the peace of mind. We'll handle the maintenance. We'll never need to see you anyway. There's no oil changes needed.
And as a direct impact to us, he also said he'd like to work with a carrier. He would like to have a traditional carrier set up this product for him. But if we won't, he's willing to do it on his own.
What do you think, Nick? If no carrier will take him up on it, do you think that he would blow himself up doing it because he doesn't understand the industry, even though he's a genius?
I'm sure he would hire the best people. But, you know, this is one of, you know, if you read very closely in between the lines, from what Warren Buffett writes in his chairman letters every year, especially those years where he focuses on insurance itself is not a great business. very low margin, intensive capital. So it's in Elon Musk's best interest to have someone else use their capital, and he can do a much better job generating value for his shareholders, building cars and other things, and not underwriting insurance. I can almost guarantee that. So, speaking of Warren Buffett, he released his chairman letter, annual report, yesterday, and you guys are very close to him. I don't know if you knew this was coming and whether you were able to buy stock, but he killed it again, another great year. And, you know, just hundreds of years from now, we will look back and he will be one of those iconic people. He's just got a way about him. He's got a personality that's just very likable. And, you know, that he did it in insurance. Nobody does it in insurance.
Well, Carly helped edit the letter this year, since we're friends now, and I helped him come up with some of his funny sayings.
That's good. That's good. He had another one. He had another one this year. Something about I don't have the direct quote, but something about when it's raining gold, you want to run outside with bathtubs and not spoons. And his point there is that when times are tough, I think that's the opportunity. And when times are tough, what do most people do? Most investors, they back off. When times are tough in the insurance market, what do underwriters do? They back off. And they usually back off at the worst possible time, such as post Northridge earthquake in California. All the insurance companies wanted to run for the hills, when in fact that would have been the best time to write business in California. So he's onto something.
But he's always talking. So on the investment side, he's a big fan of be afraid when others are greedy and be greedy when others are afraid. But on the insurance side, he is big about conservative underwriting, about if you underwrite it, and if you can't get the right price for it, sit back and let others kill themselves over it.
That's true. I would like to go into, as part of the simplified InsurTech model, I would love to be able to look at some of his deals and kind of run it through that, just to show what kind of genius we were talking about here. And the two specifically I'm thinking of are when he did the $1 billion reinsurance deal for the California Earthquake Authority in 95 or 96. And post 9/11, when he did when he wrote the terrorism policy for the Sears Tower, when no one else would write terrorism. I was having a conversation with someone yesterday, and if there was ever a time to write terrorism, it was right after 9/11, because there was no chance any terrorist was going to be able to get on a plane and fly it into a building. Not possible. So I think the guy kind of knows what he's doing.
I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about our history with Uncle Warren that we've been joking about. So the letters are classic, and he's been writing them for 30 some years, I think since 1974 maybe, and together there are a few thousand pages, and they're all available for free online. Carly and I read them, and we read them with a very specific purpose. We read them with the idea of creating an insurance specific summary kind of thing, because I had spent, we had spent years telling fellow insurance professionals that one of the best ways to understand the industry is to read the letters, but they're literally thousands of pages long. So we came up with the idea of writing a summary specific about insurance, about the things that we learned from the letters when it comes to insurance. And we wrote a 3 or 4 article series, which was very popular. And the really funny part is we called it Dinner with Warren Buffett. And we started, the first two paragraphs on the first one talked about Warren Buffett being a big fan of INS Nerds, giving us a call, inviting us to meet him in Omaha, flying us NetJets, and getting to have dinner with him. And then on paragraph 3, we confess that this is just daydreaming, and that really all we're doing is doing the second best, which is going over the letters, because we haven't had the chance to really meet him. And so many people in so many conferences to this day come to us and go like, oh my God, I can't believe you had a chance to meet Warren Buffett.
Well, I think as part of the podcast, maybe it makes sense this week, we should republish that and kind of as a salute to Berkshire Hathaway and the letters. I think that would be a great idea.
Absolutely, and like you were saying, the letter this year is as good as it has been every year. It continues to be a fantastic introduction to the industry, and he puts it into the simplest possible terms that you can put insurance. It really, I have so much of it highlighted that it would take me an hour just to go through the highlighted stuff. I highly recommend people read the letter, and that they read our previous Buffett articles.
Okay. Carly, any opinion about Uncle Warren?
I echo everything Tony has said. I love reading the letters, and I think it's a fantastic way to get your feet wet. And
if you've ever met have you guys ever met anyone from Omaha, Nebraska?
Yeah, I lived in Iowa, so I know many people from Omaha, Nebraska.
And so every person I've ever met from Omaha, Nebraska, I always ask them, have you met Warren? Have you bumped into Warren? No one has.
Has anyone said
No,
no one has.
Okay. No one has. But, you know, HBO just came out with a documentary. Do you guys get HBO?
I don't even have cable.
Oh.
Me neither.
Jeez, guys, come on.
See, I should put a parenthesis here and let our listeners know that one of the reasons that we brought Nick on, not only was he willing to do the legwork on the podcast, but you know how startups like to bring adult supervision? Nick brings 20 years of maturity into our sometimes duct tape together ideas.
So if you don't have HBO, how do you watch Game of Thrones?
I'm about 5 seasons behind on Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I'm on season 2. It's streaming on Amazon.
I've only watched season 1. Eventually, I will stream it.
It's on Amazon.
Yes.
Okay. I talk to people that haven't seen it, and they're like, I don't want to get HBO. Now I can tell them there's another option. But
well, now you can get HBO Go by itself without a cable contract.
Yeah, you can. But
and it's cheap.
$10 a month.
Yeah.
HBO
sponsor.
For $10, guys, spend the $10 one month. There's a hour and a half documentary on Warren Buffett, and like you've never seen him before. And you would think a guy that's worth, what, $60, $70 billion? You would think like certain characteristics would change. So he did have a very nice car, much better than I thought. But every morning he either goes to McDonald's or some other place, and he had the change. He had it all counted out. He orders one of two things, and on that day he's got exact change. He basically orders, goes to the drive-up teller, hands over the exact change, and they do a swap with the bag. And the person on the other end, I don't think they know at all who that dude is that just gave them $1.50.
He's amazing. I haven't watched the documentary. I have read the book. His official authorized biography. It's called The Snowball. It's a little long, maybe 600, 700 pages. It's amazing. He's truly an amazing guy. His history is very, very interesting. And like you were saying, he's basically the same guy. Like, he drove an old Buick for years and years and years. He lives in the same house. He lived in Omaha from when he first started. He's a regular guy, basically, a genius regular guy. Yeah. And he is 86 years old now, 86 and a half years old. And I hope to in the next few years, while he's still alive and active, I hope to make it to Omaha for a for one of the annual meetings. I do not own any Berkshire stock, so I'll have to buy a B stock in order to go.
Yeah, he's amazing, and you know what I learned from Snowball, and this is not to throw praise on the guy. What I learned from Snowball is he's a highly flawed human being, highly flawed, and you know he got particularly focused on money at an early age. You want to talk about how to sell, Carly, and doing it in an easy way. This kid was selling, he would buy 6 packs or 12 packs of Coca-Cola and sell them individually. And he would do it with packs of gum. So, you know, he'd buy a pack of gum, a 10 pack of gum for $1, and he'd sell the individual pieces for like 15 or 20 cents. You know, small margin stuff, but he learned how to sell. He learned how to make money. He's incredibly stingy. He didn't have necessarily the greatest relationship with his kids. That was, you know, even as you watch the documentary, the kids admit, if you wanted affection, we didn't go to dad. We went to mom. And
the kids didn't even know that he was rich until they were adults.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting story.
It is.
I wish he would start tweeting again.
Yeah, it's not
because
for everyone.
That's obviously where I get most of my information. So he could tweet some more. That'd be great. I'd know all this about him.
The history of the world would be better if Warren Buffett would reply back to Donald Trump.
Yes. Yes, please.
They would be TV shows just based on that.
I'm so happy you went there, Nick.
Oh, that would be phenomenal.
See, if we can take the assumption that the further into each podcast we get, so let's say minute 3, we should probably be careful what we talk about. Minute 45, we could probably be a lot more free in what we talk about. So I guess after minute 40, we can talk politics, if Carly allows.
Well, let's end on a high note, then.
Please.
Yeah.
What else do we have for today, Nick?
Okay, we'll end on a high note, and so... Carly, Tony, what can the audience expect from insnerds.com and publications this coming week, assuming that we can get this podcast online in the next day or so?
So this one, basically, we're recording on Sunday, and we're publishing 1 week later on Monday. So what we're talking about that's coming out next week is probably already out by the time people listen to this.
Okay. So... what do we have in the pipeline for 2 weeks? What can people expect coming forward?
For two weeks, we never have any idea.
Okay, well, why don't I answer that? I am going to try to start a weekly picking an insurtech company, running it through my little model, giving some background on what I think the company can and can't do, and whether I think they're going to make a difference or not. I'm going to try to do that weekly. So I don't know which companies yet I'm going to focus on, but I have a pretty good idea. One of them will be Lemonade. We'll definitely have to do that. But there are thousands of others, and I'll pick some good names, and we'll try to do that.
I think we'll also probably have another Why I Love Insurance. This one has kind of a funny story. This person joined, became a contributor, wrote it, and then our system failed to let us know, so it sat there for 6 months. I accidentally found it last week, and I emailed him and apologized, and I told him, hey, we want to go live with it. Do you want to revise it? And he said he would. So that What I Love Insurance will probably go out this week. Carly, anything else that we might have this week?
At this time, I don't know of anything coming up. Hopefully, I'm excited that we're going to get more submissions from Taryn. I think she's got a really great voice, and hopefully we'll have some more from her. We will have reposts of some articles I wrote for my AM Best column coming in the next few weeks. I think we're really generating a lot of great ideas, so keep watching insnerds.com.
What I'm most excited about is episode 1 going live. And hopefully by the time episode 2 goes live a week later, we'll have twice as much traffic on the website. We'll see. Overall, it's going great. I mean, like we were talking about just before recording, we keep breaking records every week as to how much traffic we're getting compared to previous weeks.
Good times, good times. Okay, guys. Well, this has been the Profiles and Risk, the INS Nerds podcast. Thank you for listening to episode 2, and look for episode 3 and all of our articles at insnerds.com.
Hit the subscribe button and tell your friends about it. And if we are already on iTunes, which takes a little while to get there, go ahead and give us a rating on iTunes. We always look forward to hear from our listeners and readers. And thank you very much for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.